Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in once again as we continue to rummage through this monster box of baseball cards stored away in my belongings for many, many, many years, and primarily cards from the 1980s, my childhood, and chances are yours too, and chances are you have a box of these cards just laying around the house somewhere. Going through set by set here, we're into 1984, the final set of 1984 to look at. 84 Tops, one of my personal favorites, and a lot of hobbyists like this card. We'll talk about the card design. Our random pull from the stack of 84 Tops, card number 778, Andy Hawkins. And I know I've got a lot of fans from the San Diego area, so I'm sure you're thrilled to see Andy Hawkins. Or maybe not, but we'll find out. So we'll take a look at Andy Hawkins' rather interesting career, to say the least, not only as a pitcher, but as a pitching coach, and the legendary 84 Tops design. We've got a lot to go through with this podcast, a lot of fan interaction through our Twitter handle, at Wax and Gum Stains, and also plenty of memories to share, based on some of those questions, and again, the 84 Tops review. But first, I'd like to dedicate today's podcast to the late Gene Wilder, as you know, passed away on Monday, August the 29th. If you listen to our 84 Donruss podcast just a couple podcasts ago, I mentioned how 1984 was not just a great year for hobbyists and for baseball fans in general, but for me personally, for a number of reasons. And one was that was when I was first introduced to the movie Young Frankenstein, which, of course, Gene Wilder was one of the main characters in. And if you were a kid like me, I was turning 7 years old in 1984. If you're a kid like me, shortly after Young Frankenstein, you probably also saw Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Blazing Saddles when you were a little older. When I got a lot older, I appreciated movies like The Producers. Gene Wilder, a tremendous talent. I'm a guy who loves comedy. And even though he said that he wasn't a really funny guy, he just happened to be funny on film, he was not only funny, he was a tremendous actor, and anybody who enjoys fine acting, great comedy, and great execution of comedic acting, you remember Gene Wilder, who again passed away earlier this week at the age of 83. I'm sure you have memories of your favorite Gene Wilder movie, too. Chances are it's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you want to share them, go ahead. You can do so at Wax and Gum Stains. Of course, our main topic of conversation is baseball cards. We've got some reaction from our previous podcast on 84 Fleer and a couple of interesting submissions on the worst card trade you made. Let's start off with Andy Viker, who checks in. Still kicking my own butt that I bought the Topps traded box set and not the Fleer update box set. We were talking about how nice of a set the 84 Fleer set was, but the real gem was the 84 update set, which came out late in the summer of 1984, and that's because Fleer, not only was it their first update set, but they were also able to really jump ahead of Topps and Donruss with the release of a Roger Clemens rookie card and a Kirby Puckett rookie card. And those sets are very hard to find. The individual cards you can still find relatively easy, but Fleer did not go overboard with production in 1984, so it is a little bit of a tough find to get those individual cards, never mind the entire update set. So Andy, if we all knew then what we know now, we probably would have invested our time and money a little better in the purchasing of cards, because I've made some bad non-purchases as well. Case in point, I remember 1990. Remember, I was only into card collecting for maybe a year or two at this time. And even though I was collecting cards, every baseball card I could get my hands on, I remember I was in a Toys R Us, and there was a big bin of Donruss rack packs. And while I'm looking at this big bin of Donruss rack packs, there are a couple of rack packs of, and I kid you not, 1975 Tops. And me, being a 12 or 13-year-old kid at the time, not even thinking about the absolute gem cards I could have gotten in those rack packs. All I could think of was, I don't want these old cards. I want the new ones. So, yeah, that's my story of regret there. But Andy, like I said, if we knew then what we know now, But don't kick your butt over it. I mean, sometimes you just miss out on opportunities like that. And always look out for the next best opportunity. And hopefully you can track down some cards and sets that you like, even though you passed up a good opportunity or two. For you, 84 Flair Update. For me, 75 Topps Wax Packs in a bin at a Toys R Us. Dan Sierras checks in. He says, Flair and Donruss were always my favorites as a kid in the 80s and 90s. And while I can't necessarily say, Dan, that Flair and Donruss were my favorites, because I really like Topps, too. A lot of great Topps cards coming out in the 80s. Some, not so much. But as I mentioned with our 83 Flair and our 84 Donruss podcast, I really thought those sets really set the bar for those respective companies. I think in 84, Donruss finally got it right and started producing some very good cards throughout the 80s. Flair was very classy throughout the 80s and even into the early 90s, to be honest with you. I was never crazy about the banana peel yellow card that they had in 91, but I know the 92 set was a good one. The 90 set was one of my favorites as a kid. So they produced some really good cards. And again, that's not to, you know, dump on Topps, because I thought Topps had some really good cards too. But by 1984, the other two big three producers of sports cards, if you will, they had certainly upped their game quite a bit, and Topps couldn't just float along going, well, we're Topps, we've been doing this since the 1950s, you know, who needs this competition? We'll smoke them. Now, that wasn't the case certainly by 1984, as we've seen with the Donruss and Flair sets, and Topps having to put out an A-plus product as well. David R. Moore says collectors these days don't understand just how elusive the 84 Flair Mattingly was back then. It was rare to pull one. And David, as we mentioned in the podcast, Flair limited production that year, much like Donruss, not to a scarce amount, but certainly there are not pallets and pallets of 84 Flair cards, be it complete sets or vending boxes or wax boxes, like you see with a lot of other sets from the 1980s. So it's rare now, but even rarer then. You're absolutely right. All right, now I mentioned some of the worst trades. This came up in a previous podcast, and I threw the question out there. I said, tell me about the worst trade you made. Chances are you were a kid, but maybe as an adult you made the trade and you go, geez, what was I thinking? Not, and this is strictly a trade, not something along the lines like I just mentioned where, gee, I wish I bought this product instead of that product. So I have a couple of stories to share from Rounded Corners. 10-year-old traded 87 Topps Mattingly for 82 Topps Hoskin Pal autographed, not realizing the whole 82 Topps set was stamped with signatures. Everybody now, womp, womp, oh, the 82 Topps set, which, as we've discussed, was certainly lackluster. Not bad, but not a great set. Yeah, somebody sold John the, hey, it's an autographed card. So that's tough. But Hoskin Powell, Rounded Corners apparently is a Twins fan or a Twins collector. So you know what? If you had to complete your 82 Topps set, you needed Hoskin Powell. But giving up the 87 Mattingly for 82 Hoskin Powell is a little lopsided. Now, the good news, Rounded Corners, is that because of overproduction, the 87 Topps Mattingly is worth about as much as the 82 Topps Hoskin Powell. So you can go out and get all the 87 Topps Don Mattingly cards that you've always wanted. And by the way, Rounded Corners throws in the note, I've never forgotten Hoskin Powell, that's for sure. That's bound to happen when you make a bad deal. For me, I've never forgotten the 75 Topps set. Jason Presley checking in. My worst trade was a 72 Topps Hank Aaron for a set of 87 Donruss highlights. This was in 1988. So to give Jason a little bit of a break, in 88, you wanted all of the hot cards from 1987. I get that. But much like I was saying earlier in the podcast, if we knew then what we know now, the ratio, I'm trying to think of the ratio that I gave Jason here. Let me look it up here. Oh, yeah. The ratio of existing 72 Topps Aaron cards to 87 Donruss highlight cards is approximately 1 to 87,900,575,000. I might be slightly off, plus or minus one or two million, But yeah, that's one that I would definitely regret as well, especially because it's Hank Aaron and also because it's 72 Tops. And even though 72 Tops, you could still get your hands on a lot of those cards. They're becoming a little more scarce, and I don't mean they're disappearing. It's just as collectors get them, they're getting locked up. You know, they're getting bolted down in the really thick plastic holders, and they're pretty much disappearing from the market. They're held up in everybody's collection, so it's becoming a lot harder to find those cards. And people will spend a lot of money on some of those cards. You know, I make more money now than I did when I was a 13-year-old kid, but I'm still pretty smart about not overspending for cards. And if you go to eBay and you just type in, you know, Topps baseball lot and just the year that you're looking at, you'll find plenty where there are sets with 200, 300 cards, and they're selling for $200 or $300. And these are for, you know, excellent condition cards from 1973, which I think is a little too much. But there's still a market out there for those cards, and they're still very, very hot. So plenty of interaction from our fans at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Thank you so much for putting out your questions, your comments, your memories of bad trades or purchases you wish you didn't make on behalf of another purchase. As always, you're welcome to chime in at any time at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, and please tell a friend to follow our Twitter feed and also this podcast, as we have moved our hosting to Audio Boom, and we're very glad to be putting up podcasts reminiscing about our childhood hobby all these years later on Audio Boom on Tuesdays and Fridays. All right, let's take a look at the random card pull we have for this podcast. Number 778 from the 84 Topps set. It is Andy Hawkins. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the card design first, and then we'll talk about Andy Hawkins. The 83 Topps set was a phenomenal set. A lot of the elements, as I pointed out in that podcast, there's a lot happening on the 83 Topps card that all just seemed to work. And because it was such a popular idea in 83, Topps pretty much said, well, why mess with a good thing? And they did a very similar product in 1984. Now, as opposed to the 82 Donruss slowly morphing into the 83 Donruss, where you had two very average sets, 84 Topps, not average. I would still put it at above average and still very available. They did not limit the production like Donruss and Fleer did. Now, while that brings down the market value of said cards, still, this is a very easy set to get your hands on, and I highly recommend, if you're somebody who hasn't actually picked up some 84 Topps cards, go ahead and get some. You can get wax boxes for a decent price. I've seen them $70 to $80 on eBay. I actually sold one on eBay a while back and bought it probably about 10 years ago for about $35, sold it for about $75. I want to say maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. So the wax product is still out there. The packs are still out there. Sets are still out there. Vending boxes, although those are limited in number, still out there. It's a fun set, and you'll see why. Let's take a look at the front of the Andy Hawkins card. Much like 83, where you had the picture-in-picture, you have that in 84, although the big difference is the smaller picture is in a square, while in 83 it was in a circle. Also, the smaller picture had a colorized background. You know, in the case of Andy Hawkins, it's a pink backdrop. Other players had a green or blue, I guess just whatever worked with the team's color scheme, or actually not with the color scheme. It was something that stood out from the color scheme. Of course, the Padres with brown and gold, well, why not go with pink just to get the whole 84 gobbledygook look going there. Now you have the smaller picture in the lower left-hand corner. You had the larger picture, not taking up as much space as the 83 set, but still I'd say about 85% of the front of the card is still devoted to the photograph, which was often an action shot, but you also had some pose shots. Here, Andy Hawkins not only in action, but looking like a flamingo or a man who just broke his leg, as this is a very awkward position in his follow-through here. But considering he's not looking over his shoulder, looks like Hawk was able to deliver a strike on this particular pitch. On the left-hand side, in a column form, you had the team's name, and with the team with a short name like Padres, it works very well. Things got interesting when you had Mariners or White Sox or Athletics. You know, they had to kind of scrunch those letters down a little smaller, but it looks good. And then, of course, at the bottom right-hand side, you've got the player's name and his position. So very similar to the 83 set, not quite as clean, not quite as easy flowing as 83, but for 84, it works. It's an enjoyable set to look at because, again, you've got the main photo still takes up a lot of the front of the card. You can clearly see the name of the team that the player is on. You can clearly see his name. Again, with the picture-in-picture, that's a nice touch and a pretty good quality to carry over from 1983. Overall, a very good look for Topps. Now, let's take a look at the back of the card. And this is one of my favorite features of the 84 Topps set. Even though things didn't really go crazy innovative or creative in terms of design, I just like the look of the design. Again, Topps putting their name on the back of the card. This is because of the competition. Again, all of a sudden, Topps had to put their brand on top of everything. So they went with both sides of the cards. You have the player's name at the top, all the personal data right beneath it. You've got the career stats. And if there was some room, either a trivia fact or some other unique story about the player. And in the upper right-hand corner, one of my favorite features on anything, the team logo. Now, the team logo was not in the color palette of the team logo. In fact, it was basically adjusted to fit into the color palette of the back of the Topps card, but it works. And one reason why I like the color of the back of the 84 Topps card is, first of all, it's pretty complex for what they've done compared to previous seasons. You've got the predominantly dark blue border that kind of creeps in, just above the stats as well as below the personal information. But also you've got the blue text on top of this kind of pinkish red background. And for lack of a better term, white background, which really isn't white because Topps was still using the gray cardboard stock back then. And I love this look because it's 1984. It was a very red, white, and blue year. This is when America's getting back on its feet again. It's morning in America, the ad campaign for Ronald Reagan. I remember in 1984, there was a big national spirit that started up in that year. And of course, the 1980s pretty much from then on really took off for the nation in so many ways. So you got that, you've got Born in the USA, there was this very special, unique national pride from 1984. And the red, white, and blue background, not that Topps planned it that way, but the red, white, and blue background all these years later, it still works. And it works extremely well. Like I said, there's a lot going on in the back here, not just in color, but just card design. But it looks good. It looks really sharp. And even despite the gray cardboard stock, I thought that Topps did an outstanding job putting together the backs of these cards. And like I said, anywhere you can put a logo, I am all for that. I'm a big fan of baseball logos anywhere you can squeeze them in. So again, the review of the 84 Topps set, a great front, somewhat of a carryover from 83 with the two pictures, and still a relatively clean look, not as clean as 83, but still a look that works for the 84 set. And then on the back, I really like the color scheme and just the layout. It's a really good set. Like I said, it's a fun set to collect. Even way back, when I was a kid, I would try to collect as many of these cards as possible, even though they were still kind of scarce because of the Don Mattingly rookie. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was a little hard to track these down. But later on, like when I was in college, before the days of eBay, I somehow tracked down a seller who sold rack packs, and I ended up buying five or six and just ripped right into them and started a collection there. Today, you can still get your hands on these. Like I said, they're plentiful. It's not saturated, but there's just enough out there to where there's still value, but it's affordable. If you're somebody who's on a limited budget, you can still get those packs and boxes and rack packs and rip into them and start a nice little collection of 84 Topps. Now, really, the only card that carries this set is the Don Mattingly rookie card. Topps really missed the boat on the two big rookies that Fleer was able to scoop on them in the update set. That, of course, Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett. So while the 84 set outside of the Don Mattingly rookie, doesn't exactly have that big rookie or star power as some of the other sets. In terms of card value or assortment, you still have some of the big stars or some of the players who would evolve into the big stars in the 1980s. You still had those, the young stars of the late 70s who had grown into, you know, powerful veterans in Major League Baseball. They were plentiful in this 84 set. And you've got a lot of really good names from a great era in baseball in this 84 top set. So maybe it doesn't grab you as much as the Fleer set or the Donruss set, but the top set, I love it. And most collectors love the set too. This is not one of those you like it or you hate it kind of sets like the 82 set was or the 81 set. This is one that, despite the lack of a huge rookie outside of Don Mattingly, a lot of collectors still like it. And why not? It's just a good look front and back. All right, let's talk a little bit about Andy Hawkins, who is the player featured on this random pull, card number 778. As I mentioned, quite a few listeners to this podcast are from the San Diego area and are Padres fans. So you remember Andy Hawkins. Andy was a first-round draft pick in 1978, made his major league debut in 1982. Part of the 84 Padres National League Champions team, a team that really took a lot of people by surprise. I wouldn't quite put it up there as like the 91 Braves where they went from worst to first, but this was a team I don't think too many people thought it would be the Padres coming out of the National League going to the World Series. Now, that may be a sore subject for some Padres fans because they got waxed by the Tigers in five games in that World Series. But still, that's one of the great moments in franchise history. And, you know, to be honest, they don't have a whole lot. And it's been a rough year for Padres fans. So you can still lovingly look back at 1984. And yes, those uniforms, sidebar, and you can see it with this picture of Andy Hawkins on the front of the 84 Topps card. For years, I was never a big fan of the Padres brown, but as I've gotten older and as I've kind of winced at all of the various military camouflage jerseys, and we're going to wear a blue jersey this night and a brown jersey this night and a white and blue and brown jersey that night. Now, the Padres have, I think, more uniform combinations than win streaks this year. I don't know what their marketing thinking was with that, but as I've gotten older, I've really appreciated this old Padres color scheme and this jersey. And I have to admit, I got a great deal on a Padres jersey, one of the majestic retro jerseys that you're seeing a lot of these days. Got it off eBay, and I have it. I have one now, even though I look like a big fat taco when I wear it. In fact, when I was a kid, there was a store called Taco Viva. It was in a local shopping mall, Taco Viva. I never went into Taco Viva. I never ate there, partially because it was so dark in the Taco Viva. It looked like a dungeon. But for some reason, the color scheme, the lettering, everything reminded me of Taco Viva when I see these jerseys. So these are, as I refer to them, as the Taco Viva jerseys of San Diego Padres history. But even though I used to make fun of them and I compared them to a taco chain that probably has been out of existence for 25 or 30 years, I've got one. I like it. It looks good on me. And Andy Hawkins, you know, it looks good on him here as well. And it looked good on the Padres in 84. Now, even though the Padres were a really good team in 84, Hawkins' best year came the following season in 85. He was 18-8, had an earned run average of 3.15. And the strikeout to walk ratio was almost 50-50. He had 69 strikeouts, 65 walks. That's an interesting number considering he started 33 games. So this was a guy who pretty much you could get the ball in play against him. And in fact, in 85, 228 and two-thirds innings pitch, 229 hits. So you could put the ball in play here, but he was able to string together enough wins and have enough commanding performances to really stand it out in 85. Had another good season in 86. Started going downhill in 87. Rebounded in 88. And after the 88 season, he was picked up by the New York Yankees as a free agent. And in 1989, he had his best season as a Yankee. He went 15-15, a 4.8 earned run average. But Yankee fans will still see him as a bust because this was another, I wouldn't call him a high-priced free agent, but anytime a free agent signs in New York, ask Randy Johnson, you know, the expectations are through the roof here, and Hawkins didn't really live up to those. Although, to be fair to Andy Hawkins, the Yankees were not a very good team during his time there, 89, 90, and 91. Now, Hawkins was the victim of a rather tough eighth inning in 1990 against the Chicago White Sox as the Yankees were at the old Comiskey Park. He was throwing a no-hitter until the bottom of the eighth. The Yankees made three errors, one by Mike Blowers, and then with the bases loaded, there was an error by Jim Leyritz. And to make things even doubly worse, after Leyritz erred, the usually sure-handed Jesse Barfield made an error on the play. So three errors, bottom of the eighth inning. The Yankees were trailing the White Sox 4-0. Technically, it was a no-hitter because all of these runs were picked up on errors, and all the base runners, you know, they got on because of errors. Well, because the White Sox had a 4-0 lead after eight, they went out and shut down the Yankees in the ninth. So the final score was 4-0 White Sox, despite getting no hit. And it was one of the most bizarre no-hit games in Major League history. And what makes the story even more bizarre is about a year later, Major League Baseball changed the rules and said in order for a pitcher to be credited with a no-hitter, the game had to go nine innings. So that wiped out not only Hawkins' no-hitter, but also a few others along the way. I think Melito Perez had one that was like rain-shortened, six innings or something like that. So there were several no-hitters that were just stricken from the history books of Major League Baseball. Very odd ruling at the time. So Hawkins not only lost a game in which he allowed zero hits, but then he lost the official status of throwing a no-hitter. So a very odd time in his career and a very tough time, too. Like I mentioned, after an okay 89 season, 1990, the bottom dropped out on him and, of course, the New York Yankees. But that was a very strange moment there, not only the game itself, but then losing the no-hitter 4-0, and then on top of that, losing the status of having thrown a no-hit game. And I don't know, maybe I'd have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, but if the game counts after, was it, five innings, you know, you get to the bottom of the fifth and you have games that are, canceled for, you know, rain or some other bizarre circumstances, shouldn't the no-hitter count? I mean, I don't know. Maybe Hawkins doesn't want that no-hitter on his record the way the final score went. But maybe the game should count. That's just me. Again, I'd have to look at the list of games that were stricken because there were several that were taken off the ledger then. But he has that moment in history, and that might have pretty much summed up the 1990 season. Things didn't get better in 91, as in 91 he got cut by the Yankees in the middle of the season. He got picked up by the Oakland A's, and then just 2 months later he got cut by the A's. And that was his major league career. Now, like many former players, Hawkins went into coaching after his big league career. He's a bullpen coach of the Texas Rangers for a while, served as an interim pitching coach as well. And he left the Rangers organization after 2015. He is now in the Royals system. He's the pitching coach for the Omaha Storm Chasers. That's Kansas City's AAA affiliate. And somebody needs to clean up his Wikipedia biography, because the last sentence in it says, "Despite a somewhat mediocre career, Hawkins is known for being rude to fans and refuses to sign autographs, despite the fact he should be happy anyone even wants his." So some spurned autograph seeker who wasn't able to nail down 5 seconds with Andy Hawkins, letting his or her feelings be known on Wikipedia. And that's where we stand in 2016. So while Andy Hawkins didn't exactly have the greatest of careers, he certainly did have a couple of decent years in San Diego. The unfortunate notoriety of losing a no-hitter 4-0 and then losing the notoriety of having thrown a no-hitter, yet he still looks good on an 84 Topps card. And a lot of players look good on an 84 Topps card. And it's a great set, again, to get your hands on. Still plenty of cards available out there, even some still available in wax packs. So if you got a few extra bucks, go searching around eBay or wherever you find your cards and pick up a few 84 Tops packs. They're really fun to collect and sift through, even though it's just the Mattingly card. That's the big dollar card. A lot of big name players in that 84 set. So that sums up our look at 1984. Next, we move on to 1985, and we'll take a look at the 85 Donruss set. How much better of a set was it compared to 1984? And what TV show does the 85 Donruss set remind me of every time I look at it? Maybe you'll look at it the same way or differently. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm Matt Salmon, your host for Wax Ecstatic. Thank you so much for joining us once again.